Welcome to Guerrillapreneur, the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast, teaching Davids how to defeat Goliaths. Now here's your host, Mark Anthony Peterson.
Welcome back to the podcast for entrepreneurs, startups, and business mavericks. If you're not a maverick, you don't have to go home, but you got to get up out of this podcast.
In this podcast, we teach entrepreneurs how to defeat the corporate giant. Just like in the story of David and Goliath, David defeated a much taller and stronger Goliath, not by fighting the giant in hand-to-hand combat, but by using technology. A slingshot. The slingshot allowed the smaller David to attack from a distance that minimized the advantages that Goliath had over the smaller David. My name is Mark Anthony Peterson. I am a serial entrepreneur, a futurist, and the managing executive at Serial Consulting, a leading small business strategy and technology consulting firm. I'm also the author of the book, Guerrillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for David Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, which is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. This podcast is brought to you by Serial Consulting. An idea can launch a business. A strategy can take it global. Guys, we're on Patreon at patreon.com/guerrillapreneur. Support the show and help us bring a hackerspace to Selma, Alabama, and to improve the quality of this podcast. Make a one-time donation or give as little as $1 per month. That's less than 3 non-fat lattes. If you can't donate, you can share the show with your friends. You can like the show. You can subscribe. You can leave a comment. Do it in iTunes or the Apple Podcast app, or do it at podomatic.com/Serial Consulting. In past podcasts, we have defined guerrillapreneurs as entrepreneurs who integrate sharing, gig, and circular loop economies into the design of their business as a way to conserve cash that will be invested in disruptive technology that I call slingshot technology. Slingshot technology is a traction-oriented innovation that enables the startup to price and or serve at a level equal to or better than the corporate giant. Episode 18 is a mastermind interview episode where I have a conversation with a startup owner about the issues they face in their quest to create value. In this episode, I talk with Akizi Stokes, the founder and CEO of Wonder Grubs. Wonder Grubs produces a variety of gourmet cookies using the environmentally clean protein source, mealworms. Yes, I said mealworms. Did you know that you can grow the protein equivalent of a cow in a coat closet using mealworms? I didn't know that until Akizi enlightened me to the benefits of using insects as a protein source in our diet. If you care about the environment, you need to hear this interview. Music for today's show is brought to you by the 23-year-old London-based singer-songwriter Helena Misi, featuring her song, I Had to Burn. Enjoy the song throughout the show. I will play it in its entirety after the interview. Now, let's get into my interview with Akizi Stokes, founder and CEO of Wonder Grubs. I have a wonderful guest on the podcast today, Akizi Stokes, founder and CEO of Wonder Grubs. I met Akizi at the Lithonia Farmers Market in Lithonia, Georgia. I spotted her banner, which read Wonder Grubs, from across the market. My first thought was, this booth must serve super soul food, much like the grub my brother and I would get at my grandmother's house. I had no idea that Akizi would be selling gourmet cookies made from mealworms. Because mealworms are your main ingredient, you have created a product that uses a clean protein that addresses food sustainability. Before we discuss Wonder Grubs and mealworms, tell us about you and what led you to launch Wonder Grubs.
So I grew up in a small southern town named Thomasville, Georgia, which is way, 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 way down south. It's right on top of Florida. And actually grew up on a farm with my grandfather. He was a sharecropper who eventually did come to own his own acres. So he did actually get his 40 acres and a mule. And so he built his own home. So he was probably the earliest model of entrepreneurship for me. And so we definitely lived from farm to table. So I was definitely clear on that. From there, went to Emory and stayed in Atlanta after graduating from Emory. And I've always kind of dabbled in entrepreneurship. My dad owns his own company, a small business systems company. So I've always watched people kind of start to create their own destiny, if you will. But I've always been interested in food. So I've always been interested in cooking. My mother and father were very much hippies. So we were eating tofu before it was cool. My mother was always into herbs, so we didn't do a lot of medicine, and she was always into how food healing you, and very big on how you utilize water and things of that nature. So the partner that I have now that I met, he went to Emory as well, and he is from New York by way of St. Thomas. So he's very big into water conservation. So I met my soulmate, if you will, very big into water conservation, aquaponics, and things of that nature. And we were watching a show by Anthony Bourdain, and he was in Haiti, and he tried to do a noble thing of like feeding people. And this was after the earthquakes that happened there, and kind of chaos broke out. And he was like, he was sad he didn't have the foresight to kind of see how people who've been hungry for a couple of days, how it might impact them. And he was like, stupid American kind of thing. And I started thinking, wait a minute, through my travels and my boyfriend's travels, we've been to a lot of places where people either don't have access to water or access to clean water. And I worked for the Carter Center for a number of years. And so that gave me some additional insight into just what type of environmental issues people face. And when you talk about food security, things that we take for granted, you know, we're selling bottled water, for God's sake. But some people drink from the same water that animals clean themselves in. And so when you talk about disease, when you talk about rain collection, when you talk about land crisis, people fighting over land, so you don't even have land to grow food on. I started thinking of ways that people could grow something with just a couple simple natural resources. So I started looking at insects, and there are two professors, two scientists in Germany who in particular were using mealworms for a number of things. I know there's a couple of companies here in the States that use crickets, and crickets are the craze. But when we started looking at crickets initially, they use a lot of water, actually, a lot of space to grow. They're quite noisy, and crickets are quite smelly as well. So we were like, okay, we don't want to head down that road. My boyfriend was like, no, you cannot grow those in the house. So when I started looking at mealworms, they're almost completely sustainable animals. So their castings, you know, as they're going through their growth stage and maturation, you can use it as fertilizer in your garden. You can use them to compost waste. They actually eat through newspaper. They eat through plastic, low-grade plastic resins. So they're actually looking at them to kind of eliminate or help with landfills. And then you can also eat them. And so when I started looking at what it took to grow them, they proliferate in places that are very hot, which is where most places have drought issues and land issues. They also don't require any direct water to grow or eat. They actually burrow, so they don't require a lot of sun. They actually shy away from light, so they burrow. And you can have the space of a closet to grow the equivalency of a couple of cows in terms of how much space you need. So when I started looking at them, I was like, oh, these things are incredible. And when you roast them down, about 50, they go from 30% live to about 50% roasted, their weight in protein, and the rest are good fats and fiber and other nutrients. So I started trying to think of a way to introduce them into the United States market, in the Southeast in particular. A lot of competitors are just not in the Southeast because, you know, if it moves, we fry it and dye it. And you know, we eat it. If it moves, we eat it. So I was like, hey, a cookie, desserts. People like desserts. They're not intimidating. They're friendly. And I started experimenting with recipes. How can we make it taste good and also be healthy for you? So we also took the sugar out. So we use a natural sweetener now. So it's zero sugar. We took the soy out. We also took the dairy out. We don't even use almond milk or rice milk even. So we took the nut out as well. We use like a chickpea as a binder. And so we finally got the taste down. This is kind of my background and how I kind of got into this. Trying to find ways that were affordable for people to eat. And also eventually becoming a farmer myself and to start harvesting the worms myself and showing other people how to do it and making a business out of that, kind of extending the business. So even if you don't eat them, you could become a farmer of them.
Wow, that blows my mind. Are you telling me that I can have the protein equivalent of a cow growing in the space of a coat closet? An environmentally friendly protein versus the methane-producing cow?
Yes, and kind of in keeping with that, Mark, they don't emit any methane at all. It's another plus. So no methane gas, no emissions, not even a percentage of 1%, zero.
This sounds like superfood. Why is this the best-kept secret in America?
The U.S. is, you know, in terms of other countries or continents, is a baby. You know, we're infants. So when you talk about Asian countries or African countries or South American countries who have been around for thousands of years, insects have been a large part of the cuisine and are a normal part of the cuisine. So again, in our travels, we found, you know, a lot of this is even street fare. You know, you can get a mealworm taco, you know, in Mexico and South America, you know, in Brazil in particular, places like that. So cooking or a friend of mine, she actually consults in Brussels. And she's like, oh, in the corner store down the street from my loft, now they sell salads with crickets on the top. You know, so it's not a foreign concept. Here, it's never something that's been, you know, readily introduced. And there's an ick factor. And we see bugs, we associate them with negativity. You know, we pesticide them to death. We kill them, you know, when they're in our house, they're an inconvenience. So we've never really looked at them as a food source. And it's also looked at as something being associated with people who are quote unquote poor or destitute versus nutritional or healthy and lessening, you know, the carbon footprint on our earth.
Based on what you're saying, mealworms could ignite an urban farming movement.
Definitely. So that's the long-term plan that we have. I've started to get a little buzz in Atlanta. So we've been in the Atlanta Business Chronicle. We're featured and we've got another feature coming up, but that is definitely where we want to head. Going into an area, a plighted area or area that is economically challenged and saying, okay, hey, let's take a small dilapidated building and let's turn this into something. So he and I kind of combining our ideas of him taking the aquaponics and how we can use that to grow with water the food that's needed to farm with, and then taking the waste from that and using that to feed those worms so that we have a completely recyclable building, a way of growing food. So when you talk about the urban farming, bringing some kids in from local schools, having some interns from some colleges around the area and showing them how to create their own supply, how to become a part of the supply food chain. And that's one of the things. I lived in DC for a couple of years and I definitely saw food deserts and they're real. And I'm starting to see them here. And so how can you create your own food source, not always being a consumer, but being a supplier? And that's where I don't see a lot of us today and a lot of kids today. How do you become a part of it? Not always consuming something and not always selling something from a retail standpoint, but becoming a wholesaler. What does that look like? What does that mean? So this is definitely something that could do that. And something that could be international, worldwide. It doesn't have to be limited to domestic market. There are definitely people who are looking for this product who use it in large volumes overseas. So how do you become a part of that supply food chain?
Which countries use mealworms as a major source of protein? Mealworms could end up being the export crop for these future urban farmers we've been talking about.
There are a lot of things that are happening in places like Amsterdam, Scandinavian countries in particular. The type of things that they're doing are phenomenal. Like, they're light years ahead of us, just even in the policy making. Places like Singapore, China, South America, Brazil, places like Venezuela, they're about 80% of the world eats insects in some form or fashion. It may not particularly be mealworms, but other types of insects. There are a couple of companies like Hot Licks and some others that I followed for a while. I think he's originally from Pakistan, who went to UGA the world of ophthalmology. He started his company. He's kind of ahead of the curve, and he started out with products, and now he's doing supply. So he's supplying some restaurants in New York who started actually serving up insects and trying to make it a part of everyday cuisine. So there are Ghana, Kenya, Lagos, Nigeria, so places like that. So I think in 5 or 10 years, just like with sushi, when I think about sushi 20 years ago, the thought of eating it was very foreign for Americans. And now you have sushi bars. I think in 15, 20 years, or even sooner, the landscape for this type of food product will look very different.
Let's drill down on this a bit. You launched mealworms in the U.S. using a cookie. How has that been received? Are you selling into traditional channels, or are you targeting boutiques?
So I definitely, I went through a program, an accelerator program here locally, hosted by Emory called Start Me. And they're all about social entrepreneurship, which is what I'm focused on. So there definitely were a couple of people who were like, oh, you could do this as a boutique. And I'm like, that's not where my passion lies. That's not the intent of my business. The intent of my business is to feed people and is to be an affordable food source and something that's also healthy and tastes good for them. That's also nutritional. So I could charge a lot more for the product. There definitely was a response from different places, but that's not where I want to go. I want to go after, I want to be accessible to the everyday man, if you will, man or woman, everyday consumer. So there's certain things you see as staples. I would like this to become a part of that staple that you buy. That you put in your refrigerator or freezer, not something that you can only exclusively buy at certain type of boutique stores for an astronomical price. So that's not where we want to go with this business. And in terms of the supply, I've actually started to see a couple of products on the market, like spaghetti sauces and meatballs, you know, things like that, just kind of an everyday food. So, and actually the response has been great in Atlanta. We found that our market is like women who are from 25 to 45 years old, who are concerned about health and are concerned about fitness, but they're not fanatics about it. They're not your CrossFitters, people like that. And those people like the product as well, because it does give them an alternative sense of protein without all of the fat and without all of the sugar. And it actually tastes good. I used to bodybuild and I didn't care about taste before. I just wanted the protein. You know, I wanted to get a certain reaction from my body, a certain look. So if it tastes good, that's even better. So actually the response has been great. We went to Essence Fest earlier this year, got in and we told them what was going to be in the product. And the response was phenomenal. So it helped us.
Given what you just described as your target market, people who want protein as a source of energy, clean, healthy protein to power their workouts, I could see your cookie as a complement to Gatorade. The people who consume Gatorade, the hardcore athletes, should love this cookie. If you think about it, Gatorade, when it first launched, was much like sushi. The taste wasn't great, and people looked at it with their, but they could not deny the success that the Florida Gators had, and they thought, maybe we should drink it too. Is that what you're thinking? Are you planning on marketing your cookie like Gatorade, a performance food, and leverage that market niche as an entry point into the larger market?
That's the hope. I tried to do it the opposite way, and that's not working as well. And I have a small team that I work with out of Emory, and they were like, performance, let's go with performance first. And they're absolutely right. And so that's what I'm finding out. I have a couple customers who are regulars, and these are definitely women who work out. I'm getting ready to pull them at with a couple of Zumba crowds. So yeah, so that is our goal now for the next 6 months, is to focus on the everyday woman who works out and also man. So anyone who's doing Zumba, someone who's a cyclist, someone who's a runner. And again, these aren't people who necessarily are highly competitive. We're just kind of looking for everyday fitness. And like you said, looking for some energy, looking for something that's low in calories, you know, high in energy, high in kickback. And that's also affordable and also tastes pretty good.
That's the first thing that came to my mind. The Kenyans who keep winning all those marathons, wouldn't it be great if they crossed the finish line with one of your cookies?
Yes. That would be awesome.
Kenya, Ghana, and these other markets already are consuming these mealworms. Why not launch internationally first?
I just hadn't thought about it. Things went much faster than I anticipated, so I hadn't considered it. And it's funny you mentioned that. The last meeting I had with the team that's helping me, it was a small team who actually gave me a microloan. That was one of the things we talked about. One of them actually has a connect with some cyclists here who are connected with some international cyclists. And he was like, have you ever, and he's actually originally from China. And he was like, you hadn't thought about that? And I was like, no, I hadn't. So maybe something I look into and explore. And when I think about it, I have a lot of international friends who travel. And it just never entered my mind. I probably thought, I don't have the audacity to do that, but why not?
Yeah, I mean, I would think that that would be an easier path, because the mentality is already there to consume these sorts of items. And then if you're bringing something innovative into the market that's not currently offered, using that ingredient has a probability of catching on.
All right, I have to give you 10% if that works out, Mark.
Hey, well, we're not just going to talk about it. We're going to get together and drill down on this a little bit more, because I'm fascinated. Yeah. By this is very, very fascinating, because of all of the sustainable benefits. When you look at it from every dimension, you're absolutely right. This is the future of farming. And if people can get over, like, the ick factor,
yeah,
this could be a core ingredient that really provides a lot of protein to middle and low income families.
Yes.
Across the world. So.
Yes. And Georgia could be one of the first to do it. That was kind of my sell. I had a really hard time getting the permit for this business.
Talk us through that. What was that process like?
Normally it takes about 2 to 3 weeks, and it took me about six to seven months. First submitted my application, and the woman who eventually approved me shall remain nameless, but I'm forever in her debt. When I first approached her with the idea, when she brought me in, at first she denied my application. And I asked why, and she said, well, you don't have a shared kitchen that you're going to cook your product out of, and no one would touch me. So it was kind of like, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? So anytime I would go to a shared kitchen to say, hey, can I put you down on my application? They were like, well, are you permanent first? And I'm like, well, I can't get the permit. Let's have a shared kitchen listed. So I actually went to a shared kitchen here in Decatur, and it took her 2 years to get her shared kitchen. She changed the game of being able to do it. So I thought, okay, here's a woman who was innovative. Maybe she'll appreciate that about me. So I went and I waited for her GM for about 2 hours, unannounced, no appointment. And she finally came out and met me, and I said, hey, I can't get this permit unless I could put down a shared kitchen. Can I use your shared kitchen? And she and I literally sat down for over the course of a couple of days and kind of mapped out how I needed to bring this product in, what it needs to look like, how I needed to cook in the kitchen, what guidelines I needed to follow. And I took that information back to the Georgia Department of Agriculture and said, hey, I met with the woman that you said you know, the GM, and she said she'd let me in provided I do these steps. And she said, okay. And she still kind of gave me a bit of a hard time. Another month went by, my application still wasn't approved. And I said, well, what's the problem? And she said, honestly, we've just never done this before. No one has ever come to us to use insects in a food product. So I did my own research. I brought some books back to her, some links, some sites, some information. So I informed her as much as she informed me. And I said, by the time we're finished with this process, you and I are going to be really great friends. And we were. So by the end of 6 months, I was in her office and she was showing me what exactly I need to do to put on my labels. And so I did everything she asked me to do. And I finally got approved and got a permit. So we're actually the first in Georgia to receive a permit for insects in a food product.
So yeah. That shared kitchen piece was another aspect of launch that I try to stress to a lot of entrepreneurs. Find a way to push that capital investment off.
Yeah.
Until you have a proven business concept and you've hit the tipping point where bringing it in-house makes sense. So after you get the permit, what were you targeting and thinking about as you move from permit into product stage?
Things that are seasonal. So in trying to keep with our sustainability approach, using fruits or vegetables that are available during this particular season. That was number one. Number two was the grubs actually naturally have a nutty type taste. So then trying to figure out what complements that. So we landed on, and actually polling it with people too. What do you like? So chocolate chip, you know, chocolate and nuts go well together. The oatmeal cranberry raisin, you know, that goes well with nuts. So and things that are kind of hearty. And so what other, when you're talking about someone who is a cyclist or someone who's a runner, you know, the grub, the protein isn't just the only thing I'm looking for. What other type of things can I put in there that are going to create chemical reactions in your body? They're going to give you the punch that you want, lysine or any something that our bodies don't naturally produce but need to make that muscle grow back stronger. So what other foods do that? What other spices do that? So we looked at that as well. So at talking to people who are bodybuilders, and so what type of things they're supplementing with, could I put that into the cookie as well? So that's what we looked at when we were doing the recipe. So it was a whole food once we finished making the whole product. And also cutting that sugar out. We actually have a vegan line as well. Some people don't want the grub, but they like the fact that it didn't have anything else, any other allergens in it. So we started taking, kind of leveraging that market as well, saying, okay, we have a vegan option as well. For those who are truly vegan, who don't want any type of animal byproduct, we have something for you also with the same health benefit.
Tell us the types of cookies you have. There's a chocolate chip, it sounds like.
Yep, chocolate chip. There's an oatmeal cran. There's an oatmeal raisin and also an oatmeal cranberry pecan cookie. We also do pecan praline. We're at Decatur Books Festival early this year, and we introduced a lemon lavender cookie, which actually was very, very popular. And we actually use true organic dried lavender flowers in it. And then we're looking at now a cranberry orange cookie that we want to introduce. So we're kind of testing that out right now. And I think that's... And peanut butter. Peanut butter, we stopped using the peanut butter. It was a little cost prohibitive, and we just didn't have as large a response to the peanut butter as we had hoped or initially thought. So that one we've discontinued for now. And those are the ones we have so far. But we also have some other food products waiting in the wings that we introduced during the accelerator program, but I haven't put on the site yet. So a bug sushi, actually a version of dumplings with a bug sauce. In addition, we're looking at, we have a stir fry mix, and we have something called arancini balls, which are like rice balls. It's Sicilian street food, and a couple other things we're looking to introduce. So we have an event we're going to try to have in February to just have a tasting so people can come out and check these other food products out and give us their feedback.
As you were laying out your ingredients, a few things kind of popped to my mind. How far off is a cookie from a bar?
It's funny. So initially we looked at doing a bar, and there are 1,001 bars on the shelves.
And but there are none with insects in them.
None with insects, but we thought that's a pretty established market. It's a really tough market at this point to get into. And although I think we're talking to a couple of stores now, they want to place us on the shelf with bars, but we are technically a cookie, considered a cookie. But because of the grub and the health benefits, mm-hmm. we'll be amongst the bars. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we are a dessert, if you will, but a healthy one, an energy or healthy dessert, kind of sets us apart. So we didn't want to just become lumped in with another bar.
So you don't think the grub aspect of being a clean protein with less sugar, with more punch, would make it differentiated as a power bar in that market?
Not enough, in the sense that... Again, we're still dealing with the American psychology of what my food looks like and tastes like. So the mere fact that we mention grub, and sometimes when we say the word grub or mealworm, people don't, it doesn't readily register, which has been interesting. But the fact that it's an insect, once that registers with people, it being a cookie seems to go over a bit better. It's a bit more palatable for people.
Because, I mean, my mind is completely thinking about international market. You know, this sort of thing follows the pattern of a product that wins abroad and then is imported back in, you know, after you've established a base among people who already eat it every day.
Yeah.
As a product ingredient, it sounds like you're positioning it almost like a pasta with that sort of nutty texture feel.
Yeah.
Is that the only area where it could work? Because the other place my mind went was a morning cereal.
Yes.
Okay.
We thought about powders. Mm-hmm. We actually thought about seasoning sprinkles on popcorn and things of that nature. So there's a whole host of things.
herbs has a nutty taste, a great, it'd make a great creamer in coffee.
Yes, yes.
And so those sorts of things seem like, again, product areas that might be easier for people to deal with. They could mix it in another, with another ingredient that they already consume for their workouts or as part of their daily regimen, because a lot of people would have never thought to be using almond milk in coffee.
That's very true. Coconut, very true.
It would have completely turned people off. Today, Starbucks is selling the almond milk latte. Yeah. So
yes, yes.
So that sort of thing seemed to pop to mind as another one of those potential new product entry point. This is the kind of thing that in my discussions with entrepreneurs, I love to not only see, but participate in, because it's how David beats Goliath.
Yes.
You have to continue to be disruptive.
Yes.
Finding and looking for not only new technologies, new processes, and new products, if you're going to keep that market advantage. Because right now you have it. The big guys aren't playing with grubs.
No.
They haven't figured out the process. They haven't figured out the market. And you have that lead. And as many new products as you can figure out in your own lab.
The biggest thing with doing some of the other products, and that's where that farming license come in. And we got caught in kind of a gray area. So I have to bring the grubs in. And there's no one locally, Grubly Farms, that one of the co-founders has been extremely supportive and helpful, you know, throughout this process. And so they use mealworms, but they use worms or larvae of the black soldier fly. And we use a darkling beetle. And one of the limitations, restrictions is that although they produce grubs, they have to be food grade and they have to be in a food grade facility, which has to be completely separate than a facility you're using for livestock. So what we're having to do is ship in the grubs that we're using out of an organic facility in California, who actually supply Fear Factor. They're one of the suppliers of Fear Factor. So they've just gotten certified for food grade worms that can be used for human consumption. So that's where that farming license comes in, where I want to get that farming license. Because they're treating the grubs like a cow or a sheep or anything else. So I'd have to have a facility, but I'd have to have that farming license first to be able to grow them and sell them wholesale. So that would allow me to grow enough in volume to use them for these other products without incurring the shipping cost, you know, the transportation costs and everything in the overhead from another supplier. So that's kind of where we are right now.
That's perfect. That, you know, you're thinking about your value chain and, you know, moving into the next pieces of the business that are going to make this a long-term viable enterprise. Because without that, you're right, you're going to lose a tremendous amount of value as you ramp up if you have to continuously ship this core ingredient from the West Coast.
I want to keep the cost down for the consumer as well. Because I could buy enough, you know, from this particular supplier, but it would impact when we kind of crunch the numbers, it would kind of drive the price up of the product, and I want to keep it at a certain range.
Storage, how when you buy a shipment of grubs, does that have a shelf life of 7 days, 14 days? Or what's the shelf life of a grub once it's been delivered to you?
So once they've been delivered, there are a couple of different ways you can store them. So freezing them, we can freeze them for about 3 to 4 months, or we put them into use. Live, once we actually process them, so if we roast them, interesting enough, we can keep them unrefrigerated once they're roasted for up to a year. and I've tested it.
without impacting the quality of the product at all.
At all. The great thing about grubs as well, You keep them in some type of substrate, such as an oat bran or oatmeal, outside of the waste that you may be feeding them. But they don't have bacteria, so they don't readily themselves carry any type of bacteria. The only thing that could carry bacteria would be the substrate, so there's no spoiling point, if you will, for the worms. Some may die off, kind of clean those out, but in terms of like having an outbreak, that has yet to be found yet. Once they're cooked, if we cook them, if we boil them in that state, we can keep them refrigerated for about up to a month and they're safe to use.
This is the future. We're talking about the future. Future of food. You are going to be that lady with the picture on the side of the bag, you know? We're talking about the future of all food now. That's incredible. If you're saying roast it a year on the shelf, unrefrigerated, think of all the food deserts around the world. that if they had access just to what you described, you've changed the nutritional balance overnight.
Yes, and that's the goal. That's at the heart of what we want to do. Aside from profit, money, anything else, that when you talk about food security, that is what food security looks like for me.
Well, in addition to laying out just the operational strategy, it's going to be more apparent as the business scales that you're going to need a legal and political strategy.
Yes.
You're going to need the equivalent of the Cattlemen's Association.
Yeah.
To help make sure that there's the potential legal opposition and regulatory opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is going to be a protein that's going to compete directly with cows.
It's starting. There's a group called Tiny Farms that kind of function as a platform or a forum. A cohort for people to kind of come to who are looking to use insects for food, and they give you advice. There are companies like Exo and Chipotle. So Exo probably is the front runner on, you know, getting VC on. I think Nas actually put in, I don't remember the exact number, a couple hundred thousand into their business earlier this year. Tim Ferriss is on board with these guys. So they're trailblazers. Chipotle, I think, won Shark Tank. Bitty Foods out of California, and all of these guys are using crickets. But I think they've gotten a forum started where they're trying to start looking at regulation, because there really is no regulation specifically around insects. So they just use the traditional livestock guidelines for you. So these guys, I think, have started getting together to look at policymaking. But one of the other kind of barriers to entry that I found is being Black and female.
Okay, unpack this one for me. How does being Black and female prevent you from selling cookies with mealworms in them?
You just don't have the same, like, there are not a lot of women in this type of business. When you talk about food business, and when you look at the commissioners, you know, when you look at the boards of some of the livestock regulatory, we're not there as green lighters. We're there as coordinators and support staff, but we're not green lighting a lot of things. And we talk about the innovative market, this emerging market, it kind of looks the same. There are a couple of people, like I said, with Grubly Farms, like that co-founder, he's been phenomenal and has introduced me to a couple of people, but they haven't called me back. You know, and aside from me just being a small player or non-existent probably for them at all, I've just found that I don't see a lot of people who look like me just in that supply chain period. So it being an emerging market just makes it a little bit more challenging, like really trying to get some credibility and accessibility to what's happening in the market.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. As if selling mealworm-based cookies isn't hard enough, you got to fight an uphill battle in terms of getting credibility amongst people who are accustomed to dealing with your traditional farmers. Given this landscape, if you had a magic wand, what three things would you fiat in place to make life easier for you to launch this product?
One thing that actually the team that I work with approached me about was, and what was the only thing that was probably lacking in the accelerator program I was in, when you talk about food, it's very different from any other type of business someone else is doing because it is regulated to death, would be just a very quick and dirty how-to guide. There are just a lot of things that people take for granted that it took me a long time to figure out and work through. Liability insurance, you know, how to acquire that for this type of business. Permitting, what are the steps? What do you have to have in place before you even go knock on the door to try to get permitting from the Georgia Department of Agriculture? The second thing would be a really good mentor. So I had really good mentors out of the accelerator program. But again, when you're talking about food, you need someone who specifically knows that business. And the third thing, I would probably say time. Working full time and trying to get this type of business off the ground has been challenging just because of the time commitment I have to make to it, of just little small things you need to get done.
I typically recommend that entrepreneurs soft launch their business, work a full-time job while running their startup as a side hustle.
Yeah.
Because it's not an easy balancing act. The benefit is that you have time to perfect the business model and define your target market before you invest too much money.
Yeah.
You've been at this for a couple of years. Do you feel that you have defined your business value proposition? Have you defined what you're going to be? Cookie company? Product company like P&G? Are you planning to be horizontally integrated and operate both as a wholesaler and a retailer?
Probably the latter, where we're selling food products, but we're also a supplier. I'll never forget Dr. Quigley's his name, an econ professor. And that's what I got my degree in. And he introduced me to economics. And we had this exercise in class, this project. And he said, you know, I want you guys to go back and build a model, an economic model on what type of business, you know, what do you want to be? You know, what do you want to do from an enterprise standpoint? And after a couple of weeks, I came back and everyone was presenting out and I did my presentation. And he said, okay, Kesey, you know, what do you want to be? And I said, I want to own a quarry. And he said, what? I said, yeah. I said, you know, I thought about it and I said, I want to own a quarry. And he was like, why in the world would you want to own a quarry? And other people were like, oh, I want to be a stockbroker, you know, things like that. A CEO. And I was like, no. I was like, I want to be the guy who supplies the guy who supplies the guy who supplies the guy.
Okay. Not you just want to throw rocks at people. You want to be.
Yeah. I was like, I want to be the guy who owns the natural resource. And so regardless of what type of product you produce, you get your materials from me, from my quarry. That's who I want to be. So with this, with the Millworm business, at the end of the day, in 5 to 10 years, we may have products, we may have events where people come and you taste and you see different type of food products that are being produced. But ultimately, that like probably 60 to 70% of that company to be, we're actually supplying the powder, but also we're growing and harvesting the worms and finding new and working with scientists on new and inventive ways to use them. So everything from food to handling waste in all forms, be it landfills or be in taking care of the compost at our gardens or taking care of the waste from other farmers markets that are being used as food for our, you know, our supply, our feed. So yeah, that's ultimately where I would like us to be in 5, 10 years.
Your vision excites me. This is a complete circular loop system based around an environmentally clean protein superfood. This almost makes me want to sing the theme song from The Lion King. Your business is going to destabilize a lot of markets, but empower a lot of people. That's what guerrillapreneurs do. We shake stuff up, and then we break it. And here's what's funny. Your product is the best kept, most explosive secret in the country.
Yeah.
So tell us today where you are. How can we support your business? And then when are you going to be somewhere where people can come and meet you? Because I'm sure when they see this broadcast and they hear the things that you're trying to do, there are going to be some people out there who want to be farmers like I do. And there are going to be some people who want to try to push this mission forward to see the globalization of your business in places where people already consume these products.
Well, we have an online presence. So we're at www.wunder, that's W-U-N-D-E-R, grubs.com, one word. We also are going to get back into Essence Fest, fingers crossed, for 2018. We do a lot of different festivals throughout the year. As you mentioned earlier, we're at Lithonia Farmers Market during the summer. But what we're going to try to do, and we realize that most of our business is not going to be pushed online. So we find that because of the newness of it, you know, and the educational piece of it, people definitely feel more comfortable buying it, you know, in person. So we're going to start having some events starting in 2018. We're going to be inviting people out. We'll have it posted on our site as well. And we're going to try to do it in some areas around Atlanta, East Atlanta and downtown, where people can come out, buy the product, but also do a tasting, as I mentioned, of the product. And we're trying to get into a couple of stores locally. So we're trying to get into Sprouts, Rainbow, and the vegan product, we're trying to get into Sevananda. So hopefully you'll see us locally in those places. And we're also going to try to start putting our product at local fitness centers.
Have you thought about going direct?
Yeah, we definitely will do. We'll definitely do direct. Well, you must have been talking to my silent partner, because that was last night. He was like, you need to just send out samples. Just start sending them out. Just So that was our talk last night. Just send them out.
I think we take it one more level, and yes, we can get a list of people who have high blood pressure, diabetes, yes, people who are all kind of health concerns. You can put together a health box that says, hey, if you want,
yeah, I like that,
something, you know, almost like Fresh Direct and all these, yeah, other guys who ship from, yeah, direct to your house. There's a segment out there, certainly around the holidays, that would want the girls cookies because they can consume them and they won't have the deadly impacts that some of the other sugar-based products have.
Yeah.
Until this market emerges as a cohesive market that can be mainstreamed,
mm-hmm,
a lot of micro channels that can be tapped into and get in front of those right folks.
And now your 10% has gone up to 20% mark.
The information that you've given to us here today has been phenomenal. Before I let you go, are there two or three things you can tell to our entrepreneurs who follow the podcast?
One is to definitely need to know your product. One of the selling points for me has been in even getting people just to sample the product was because I was so educated and passionate about it, and being able to give that quick 15-minute pitch, but our 5-minute pitch, reworking the plan. You know, so you may start out one way in your business plan, and you have this beautiful marketing plan and financial plan and modeling and et cetera, but you're going to have to constantly adapt it and be okay with that. And when you talked about the soft launch, just knowing it's not going to necessarily happen overnight, you just got to keep working at it, stay passionate about it, and not give up. And so that would probably be the first. And secondly, would be the finance piece. It needs to make sense. And so keeping an account on your taxes, how you spend your money, where you're spending your money. And again, you know, kind of going back and revisiting that model over and over again and making sure that it is making sense. And I would suggest doing that soft launch and not just jumping out there and going in. There's going to be so much you can learn and sharing, just sharing your product with people. That was probably the biggest thing. From start me, I used to keep everything close to the chest and it was a secret. No, share, you know, I'm not saying share this, you know, the recipe, the secret to your recipe, but sharing about your business and what you're trying to do and where you're trying to go and doing podcasts and things like this. And it was amazing how the universe will open up in the context that you'll make and the people that you'll meet.
Sharing your ideas is your opportunity to put that candle in a dark room and attract those who've also been touched by that concept and move towards you.
Yeah.
If you never light that candle,
you'll
always walk right past each other and never will the two meet. So yeah. I've learned that, you know, secret ideas are not great ideas.
Yeah.
Shared ideas are opportunities to collaborate and win. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Guerrillapreneurs, you're going to love this podcast. Please go online, go to wondergrubs.com, order up as many of these cookies as you can. Put that positive karma out there.
Thank you. So glad you're here. Thank you for your podcast.
Guerrillapreneurs, thank you for tuning in to this episode. And I promised you I'd play Helena Meese's I Had to Burn in its entirety. Here it is.
Didn't know it was my turn, so much I had.
That was Helena Misi and her single, I Had to Burn. Entrepreneurs, listen to Helena. You will know how to grow. You will know. Helena, this song touched me. When I'm back in the UK, the first paint is on me. You can find Helena's music at her website, Helena, H-E-L-L-E-N-A, official, all one word, .com. You can also support her music at patreon.com/Helena. That's H-E-L-L-E-N-A. Or you can support her at helena.bandcamp.com. I will put these links in the show notes. Follow her on Twitter at Helena Misi. H-E-L-L-E-N-A-M-I-C-Y. If you want your music featured on the Gorillapreneur podcast, direct message me on Twitter at Gorillapreneur. Thank you, Akizzy Stokes, for coming on the podcast. And guys, make sure you purchase your gourmet mealworm cookies at wondergrubs.com. That's WUNDERGRUBS.com. Gorillapreneurs, Scott Sullivan said it best in episode 7. Be a mace. Sharpen those spikes. And remember, if you're not breaking something, your company might be the next thing that gets broken.
Thank you for listening to the Gorillapreneur, the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may also enjoy the book Gorillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. Follow Mark Peterson on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Gorillapreneur. Now I want to close with a quote from the great Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu. Victorious warriors win first and then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first, then seek to win. Keep fighting, Gorillapreneurs!